As a topic for this morning's talk, I wanted to continue with the topic from Friday, which most of you weren't there, which is a right intention, a right resolve, a right thinking, right attitude, which is the second of the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path is the primary or the most common way the Buddha talked about the spiritual path that he was offering. And so there's eight elements to this path, and the second one is called, usually translated into English as right intention, but sometimes you'll see in English translated as right resolve or right thinking. And, you know, in that, if you see Buddhism as a path, then a path is something you need to walk. So you don't walk a path by reading books. And you don't walk a path by wishful thinking. We walk a path by something you do. You have to engage and you have to get up there and walk. You go up to Chukotchi, up to Long Ridge Preserve, and go for the walk up there. And you have to, you know, it requires something of you to do the walk. And so in the same way, the path of practice that Buddha taught requires something of us. It'd be nice if it didn't require anything of us. That'd be very convenient. Save a lot of time. But it requires something of us. And so no one else can do the walk for you. You have to kind of somehow engage in it yourself. And there's a few different elements that are needed to do that walk. And one element needed is to know what the path is about, know what the goal of the path is about, and know what are what's the proper orientation or proper frame of reference for finding the path and being on the path. And so having the wisdom to find the path is the first of these eight elements, which is right view. And the way it's often described is that it has to do with understanding the Four Noble Truths. So it's, if the goal of Buddhism is to be free, is liberation, and liberation is not some vague idea of, oh, just some kind of exalted state that no one quite understands what it is. Liberation is very particularly stated as being liberation from all suffering and all the internal conditions and causes for our own suffering, to the clinging, the attachment, the ways in which the heart is held constrained in bondage. So to liberate the heart, to liberate the mind. And so if that's the goal, then the Four Noble Truths are meant to be the simplest, most direct way of finding the path, given that's the goal. And so they say the simplest way to getting there is to find the path, then, is to start tuning into that level of your experience that is suffering. Now, some people, it comes easy to do that, to notice their suffering. And for some people, not a tendency to do look at suffering, because it's kind of bad news. And there's, in order to find the path to liberation, which is liberation from suffering, you have to become sensitive to suffering, your own suffering in particular. But it's not supposed to be kind of a, you know, cosmic downer to look at your suffering. It's supposed to be the beginning of a cure. And so you look at your suffering, get sensitive to it, so you can begin understanding for yourself some of the causes and conditions that prompt your suffering to be there. And once you understand what you contribute to that suffering in terms of clinging and grasping, then it's possible to release that and find liberation or freedom or a cessation of suffering. So that's the first noble truth, the first of the Eightfold Path. The second step, which is today, is right resolve or right intention. And that is that when you want to walk a path, you also, it's helpful usually to have a good attitude if you're going to walk a path. Depending on the nature of the path, if it's going to be a really difficult mountainous path, and, you know, if you go up in the high Sierras, it's best to have a certain kind of attitude of care and mindfulness and wherewithal when you do that, so you don't just go casually out with a light t-shirt in the high Sierras and don't pay attention to the weather. You know, you have to kind of, you know, be aware of your environment, what's going on, the weather, and what you brought with you, and a certain kind of care needs to go into that kind of hike. Different kinds of hikes, different kind of paths require different things from us. If you go for a hike with kids, with children, not only do you need to be aware of the environment, But you also probably, if you have small kids, there has to be a lot of wisdom about how to get them to going. One of the wisdom is you don't go for a long hike. You take short hikes, really short. There's certain kind of attitudes about that hike that might work for you when you hike that you don't want to have for the children. Like, it doesn't really help to have competitive hiking with kids. Or, you know, it really determines a real great goal orientation. We're going to get, you know, usually you kind of want to be more leisurely. The younger the kid, the more leisurely. And realize that for the kid, that stopping and looking at the banana slug is probably the most important part of the day. And so, you know, you have to enter that path with a lot of patience, a lot of presence. You want to avoid cruelty with a kid. You don't avoid it being ill will. How could you look at one more banana slug? you kind of go with an attitude that this is what the path is about. Is you're going to go and kind of. So what I'm trying to say here, depending on the circumstances, we sometimes adjust our attitude. And different attitudes are needed in different circumstances. It's quite natural, I would say, a normal thing. In different endeavors we have, different attitudes are called for. So in the same way, if you want to do the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Path, it requires a certain attitude, a certain intentionality or a certain resolve or way of doing it, attitude. And if I say that, I can well imagine, you know, if you say it without this kind of careful preamble leading up to this, people say, you know, if I just said, oh, you need to have a good attitude, right attitude, people say, oh, you know, religion again, they're kind of forcing some kind of way of being. And I just don't want to be any particular way, I want to be free, and here religion is telling me I have to be a certain way. You know, I'm going to find another religion that's can really be free, and don't have to be told how to be. You know, the goal is to be free. But if you want to be free, it helps to have a certain kind of attitude. So some attitudes that you have don't help that freedom, and some attitudes do help. And so if you kind of naturally know what the terrain is, what the attitudes are that are helpful, then hopefully it's not an imposition, but rather it's something that you're inspired to do. And part of what you have to do in walking the path, in taking responsibility for the path, is also take responsibility for the attitude you bring. And one of the ways that I understand the second step, the right resolve, or right intention, or right thought, is that it's kind of like the minimal thing, minimal attitude you want to try to develop in order to walk the path. It doesn't mean that we have to do it really well, but what it means is that we have to try to work in this direction, towards this. Another way of saying it is that part of the path is beginning to take some responsibility for our attitude, for the motivations and the orientation that we have, and our disposition. And our disposition maybe isn't so amenable to adjustment, but wanting to come with a new attitude is quite powerful. Even just wanting to can make a difference, let alone, let's say you can't really do much because you're so grumpy. But even wanting to be kinder can make a difference, because then you might choose to act in different ways. So I think the suggestion here is that this is kind of where we begin to look at how we can change ourselves. And without some attempt to change ourselves, our attitude at least, maybe there's no path. Otherwise, it's just like, oh, you know, it's kind of wishful thinking or magical thinking. Oh, if I just kind of do this meditation practice and do these different things that Buddhism teaches, and don't really try to change myself, then one day I'll wake up and I'll be changed. I'll be liberated. And that's magical thinking, right? You have to take some responsibility for that change. And so how are we going to change ourselves? That's the question. And how are we going to change ourselves in a way that's deeply respectful for ourselves? It's not an imposition, but rather feels like this is feels right, you know, feels, you know, you want to do it. Like the example I gave, I'm sorry for these kids' examples on Friday, but that's what's my mind these days. If you go into, if a stockbroker, you know, the attitude a stockbroker brings in the stock market floor, It's probably a very different attitude that you would bring if she, you know, during lunch break she goes down the street to the daycare where her kid is and walks into the daycare. It's a very different attitude, right? You know, I hope. And so, there's a kind of, it's appropriate to adjust, take responsibility for that. Here's a story. When I was 13, my family would send me up to the mountains around the monastery to collect edible plants to be used for our evening meal. This foraging trip was the only work that I really enjoyed. Otherwise, I tried every trick I could to avoid work on my family's farm. I was still going to school, but school had no interest for me, and my anger was a welcome barrier to learning anything the teacher was teaching. Occasionally during my foraging trips, I would pass the monastery while the monks were out and about sweeping the leaves from the many pathways. The first time I saw the monks working, I was mesmerized in watching them going about their work. For many months after, I would often stop for a while to watch them sweep. They went about their work silently and with an efficiency that seemed effortless. One day, a monk walked up to me and asked what I was doing in the mountains. Immediately, I became defensive and scared. I resented anyone who tried to get to know me. So instead of answering the question, I countered by asking what he was doing. The monk smiled and answered that he had been told to sweep and that he was just killing the time until he can return to his room for a nap. As I walked home later in the day, I thought about his answer and was glad that he didn't seem any different than me. When I was required to do anything, my heart was never in it, and my attitude was that I was passing time until I could be excused. Taking a nap was certainly preferable. The next time I passed the monastery on one of my foraging trips, another monk stopped his sweeping and also asked what I was doing. Again, I resented the question. It felt like an intrusion. However, this time I did not feel as scared. Again, I deflected the question by asking what he was doing. He answered that he was doing extra work in hopes of being assigned to the kitchen, which was warm in the winter and always seemed to have one or two extra sweet rice cakes in the cupboard for the cooks to nibble on. Without saying anything, I nodded and left to continue my foraging. The monk's answer resonated with me since I too liked to be warm, and eating rice cakes was one of my favorite activities, second only to sleeping. The next time I passed the monastery, a third monk asked me the same question. This time I was surprised that I wasn't defensive or resentful of being asked. However, again, I deflected the question back to him. He explained that he was sweeping as a spiritual discipline to help him overcome his anger. Later, as I walked the mountain trail with my bag of plants, I felt a kinship with this monk. Like me, he had anger. But I was perplexed that he would want to overcome it. For me, my anger protected me. A week later, I was again outside the monastery watching the monks sweep. Yet another monk came up to me. When he asked me what I was doing, I mumbled something about collecting plants. I doubt he could hear me, my voice was so faint. But I did muster up some strength to ask him what he was doing. He replied he was beautifying the monastery so that others may be inspired in their work of spiritual transformation. Before I left him, I glanced down the well-swept paths and realized that part of the reason I was compelled to watch the monks sweep was that they seemed to be transforming the paths into something that made me feel peaceful. The next time I stood outside the monastery watching the monks, I was drawn to walk over to a fifth monk, and before he could ask me what I was doing, I asked. He looked at me with kind eyes, and after what seemed like a long but quite soft silence, he explained that he was sweeping to be of service to all who used the monastery, and in practicing this way, he hoped to find the ultimate peace. As I left the monastery that day, I thought his answer strange, as I didn't understand what he meant by service and by peace. I certainly couldn't see how these had any value for me. The next time I visited the monastery was the last time. I had an unfamiliar feeling as I walked up into the mountains. Just before I reached the monastery, I guessed that I was looking forward to seeing the monks again. I felt a warm glow of gladness in anticipation of what I would find. When I arrived at the monastery, I walked right up to an old monk who seemed absorbed in his sweeping. I inquired what he was doing. As he answered, each of his words washed over me like cleansing water. He said, "Me? I'm not doing anything at all. My ego was swept away long ago. There is no I that does anything. Now the awakened life moves through my body, my heart, my mind, and my mouth. No one sweeps, there are no paths to sweep, and there is no dirt to brush away." I was stunned by his answer. And before I could respond, he handed me the broom and walked away. I have been here ever since. So each of the monks that he meets has a different attitude about the work that he's doing. And they're all doing the same work. So it's kind of interesting that the same activity can be... can be used, same kind of work can be, the same kind of activity can call for, have different attitudes or intentions or motivations behind it. So you might think about that the life that you live, the work that you do, the activities you're involved in, what's the attitude, what's the intention, what's the disposition you have in doing that work, doing that activity? And if there are multiple options for how you approach anything, is the approach you have the optimal one? Is the one that really is what you want to express or want to live? If you have to do something anyway, then try to kind of find sincerely inside of you the very best attitude and intentionality that you would like to express in that work. Because in the long term, how you're going to be transformed and changed is not by the activity you do as much as the motivation, intention, the disposition that's behind what you do. So if you do things with kindness, then kindness is the result. The kindness becomes a disposition. If you do things with hate, hate becomes a disposition. One of the things that Buddha taught, as many people say this similar thing, he said, whatever you think and ponder upon frequently, that becomes the inclination of the mind. Many people, I think, never give any thought to where their mind mostly goes, where their thoughts mostly go, kind of the common themes. But to actually look at the common themes, what the mind does, and to realize that we're creating deep tracks in the mind if we keep doing the same thing over and over again. And it's possible to create new tracks. So it becomes easier and easier for the mind over time to go in other directions we prefer. It's very, very easy to have deep tracks of anger. And that's just going to fall into the anger almost automatically. It's also possible to have deep tracks of kindness, and so we fall into the kindness almost automatically. And part of the reason there's deep tracks is because of the repetition, the frequency in which we do things. And behind, the thing that's most important for these tracks is our disposition, our intention. In terms of the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Path, there are three general attitudes or intentions, resolves, dispositions, which are said to be counterindicated, that go against, work against the very attempt to become free. The first is cruelty. You know, this is an attitude of cruelty, disposition of cruelty, just flies in the face of trying to become free, to be liberated, to be released. And so if you want to walk the Buddhist path, you have to somehow overcome or begin lessening, working to overcome the forces of cruelty inside of you. Seems kind of obvious that, you know, if you want to be free. The suggestion I have, the suggestion I make is that cruelty is really a symptom, an expression of a lack of freedom. And so, so if we want freedom, we have to somehow work with this one. So that's really obvious. A little bit less obvious is ill will. That if we want to become free, we have to overcome the dispositions, the attitudes of ill will that we might carry with us. Ill will is a lighter thing. Ill will means you kind of have aversion, have some feeling of ill will towards something, but you're not actually engaged in thoughts of cruelty. Not really wishing the person bad, you just don't like the person, you know. And so ill will has to somehow be overcome. And the third is a little bit harder to understand, but the third is we have to overcome the clinging or craving for sensual desire. And sensual desire can be innocent, but sensual desire can also be far from innocent. And, I think for people who are basically, how to say this, there are plenty of people in our society for whom sensual desire of one form or other is a source of tremendous suffering. Some people die because of it. And people make huge mistakes, they create tremendous suffering for others and for themselves by the drive to have sensual pleasure. And so when we look at kind of the big addictions, it's very clear that when we're addicted, that somehow we're not free. And so if what we want to do is become free, we have one way or other have to overcome the forces, the tracks of addiction to sensual pleasure. And so there's a whole grade from, this very strong word addiction to milder and milder forms of clinging and craving to sensual desire. And any kind of craving or clinging to sensual desire is a symptom of lack of freedom. It doesn't mean that we give up sensual pleasure when we give up the clinging to sensual desire, but without the releasing of sensual clinging to sensual desires, we have to release some of it. We have to kind of begin loosening that clinging if what we want to do is to become free. So those three things are said to be incompatible with the path: cruelty, ill will, and sensual desire of some kind. You know, the sensual desire that's clinging or craving as part of it. So the right resolve, that's wrong resolve or wrong intention to have those three. Then the right resolve, right intention, right disposition is the opposite of those. So is the lack of cruelty, lack of ill will, and lack of sensual desire. And that's how it's worded. It's worded in the text as the lack of those three things, the absence of those three things. And some people kind of chaff at the bit because they say, well, you know, that's kind of negative, but there should be a positive attitude, a positive intention, not just the absence of something. And in fact, over and over again, commentators on this will say that in ancient language of the Buddha, the negative prefix, it's the word letter A in Pali, but the negative one says the absence of something, implies the opposite, the positive versions of that. So the absence of cruelty is the presence of compassion. The absence of ill will implies the presence of loving kindness, and the absence of this craving to sensual desire implies the presence of what's called, translated usually as renunciation, letting go. And however, before we quickly run talking about the positive ones, because then people feel good, right? And I can feel in myself as a teacher sometimes a force within me to try to please everybody, please all of you somehow, and just talk about the positive stuff. You know, I'll just talk about compassion and get kind of mushy. But before we rush, and you know, I'm going to rush there, we'll take our time, we'll get there. But I think part of the value of stating in the negative is it's actually sometimes easier to accomplish the absence than it is to accomplish the presence. So maybe you can't kind of evoke an attitude of compassion, but we can perhaps put to rest or kind of overcome or not act on the dispositions of cruelty. So it's kind of to take it to the compassion level is jumping too far. Maybe it has to go in small steps. It's a big thing just to be able to kind of drop the cruelty thing and then kind of just be kind of not have that operating. But there is this positive side to each of these three. So there's compassion, loving kindness, and oddly enough, renunciation is considered the positive side of sensual desire. So that requires some explaining. Because most people will think that renunciation is a deprivation. We have a strong association of the word renunciation, many people do, with asceticism and you know, self-denial in some kind of way. Clearly the implications in the Buddha's teaching, in the Pali word, nikkhamma, which is a little bit different, you know, maybe has different meaning associations than the English word renunciation, clearly the meaning is it is a letting go. These are kind of turning away from something, the ill will, the sensual desire, and letting, there's a kind of letting go. But the emphasis is not so much on what you're letting go of, or the emphasis is as much as what you're letting go of as it is what is gained. And that's kind of often not easily understood when we talk about renunciation. We think renunciation is a deprivation, but it's also the other hand, the other side of letting go is something that happens when we let go. We let go into something. There's something that's gained. And what's gained is a sense of happiness, sense of joy. That's what's supposed to happen. And one of the functions of meditation practice in Buddhism is to provide a sense of happiness and a sense of well-being, a sense of inner peace that becomes palpable, becomes close at hand, becomes available, that you recognize there, that's there. That when you get caught up in sensual desire, for example, you realize that if you let go of that sensual desire, you get to come back to that sense of well-being and peace, that it's so strong, so wonderful. If you're asked to let go of sensual desire and letting go means you go into kind of blah, into nothing, why would you want to let go of it? Sensual desire can be pretty good sometimes, you know? Even just fantasizing about it being good can be good. You know, temporarily, it seems to be good. But if you know that letting go of it, you're getting something better. A sense of peace, a sense of happiness, a sense of well-being, a sense of integrity. Then it's easier to let go of. So the renunciation part implies the gain of something. And part of the function of meditation and other things is to give you, teach you or show you degrees of well-being and happiness that are so satisfying that you want it to be more part of your life, a more regular thing there. And so you're willing to let go of things that stand in the way of that. Make sense? So then part of the right intention is beginning to cultivate an attitude of letting go. Have that track that you've been looking at. What can I let go of here? What's useful to let go in this situation? How can I let go? It's like a muscle that you can learn. And the better you learn at using that muscle of letting go, hopefully the wiser you are in using it. You can let go unwisely, but there is. But the fact that it can be done unwisely doesn't mean that there isn't appropriate and wise ways of letting go. And then also to arouse within us, ourselves, cultivate within us, an attitude of loving kindness. of kindness, of friendliness, of caring. A great question, and if you're wondering what to do, what's going on, you can ask, is this kind? Am I being kind? That kind of changes the way in which you'll look at a situation, sometimes quite dramatically. Is this kind? Cultivate a kindness. Now, kindness can be done in wrong ways. You can be kind in inappropriate ways, in ways that are not helpful. I learned that with my kids, that I thought I was just being kind, but sometimes kindness was not what called for, because my interpretation of kindness was to say yes. And I thought, that's what you do when you're kind, you say yes. And I've learned that you can't say yes all the time to kids. It's just bad news. So you have to kindly say no. Or you realize in the bigger picture, the kind thing to say is no, given the bigger picture. So, to have that as a kind of as a habit, is this kind? Where's the kindness in this situation? How can I be kind here? And then do it wisely. And then the last is compassion. Where's the compassion here? Is there compassion? To cultivate compassion, to look at compassion, think about compassion. Regularly when I read the newspaper, I see lots of occasions for compassion. And I try to kind of use the newspaper as a place for compassion practice. I was very moved today when I read the story of, this man who killed all those Amish girls. And so his funeral, I guess, was yesterday. And I don't know, they gave a number. There was a lot of people who came to his funeral. But half the people who came to his funeral were the Amish. And they came because of their forgiveness practice. Isn't that something? So that moved me. That wasn't exactly compassion, but they, I think, for me, I mean, but maybe it was compassionate on the side of the Amish to kind of go to his funeral, given what he's done. So to have that ability, that capacity, is quite something. And in my mind, it speaks very well of the spiritual practice and training of the Amish. And the Amish definitely, I think, they represent someone whose whole life is a kind of spiritual training. It's kind of like a monastery in its own right. So what do we, so we can make our life a monastery. We can make our life something we begin trying to transform ourselves and change ourselves by regularly making a habit of coming back and saying, what's my attitude here? Is this the attitude I really want to have? Is this the disposition? What's my disposition here? Is this a disposition I really want to have? There are times where you'll discover that you have dispositions or attitudes which you don't want to have, that you don't like. That might be the time that's really important to remember to be kind and compassionate, so that you don't bury yourselves with further hostility or anger or criticism for how you're feeling towards yourself. Oh, I'm so terrible because I'm angry. Meet yourself. Sometimes the situations where we're most hostile or most cruel, that's often the times when we need the most kindness and the most compassion. Self-compassion, self-kindness. It's hard to do because sometimes it's the very lack of it, which is maybe sometimes the fuel for the very hostility. So right resolve, or right intention, the second of the Eightfold Path, involves beginning to take responsibility for our attitude, our intention, our disposition, how we're thinking about things. And it's not an easy thing to do, but without beginning that, you're not going to, you have to begin somewhere. And hopefully, as you get into it and do it, it's something that you find deeply meaningful and enjoyable. So one more story from this magic monastery. Two young men happened to enter the monastery on the same day. One was an overconfident aristocrat who entered the monastery with a sense of entitlement. The other was a son of local farmers who had spent his life helping on the small, poor family farm. During their entrance interview, The abbot asked them why they were becoming monks. The aristocrat said that he had come to climb to the highest achievement of human life, to experience the bliss, the glory, and the brilliant light of liberation. The peasant said, "I am poor and unschooled, and I have no hope of enlightenment. However, I hope to see the Dharma in the everyday things and activities of my life. May I see the truth in the food I eat, in the work I do, and in the people I encounter." Within 6 months, the peasant was graced with liberation. The aristocrat is still striving on courageously. So one of the most precious resources you have, precious treasures you have, is your intention, your intentions, your dispositions. And I hope that you can tap into the treasure house of your own dispositions and enjoy them. Thank you.